Norton's thesis is in terms of his own explanatory variables. Map 4 shows data on the distribution of the Sus scrofa, the ancestor of the modern pig, and the aurochs, ancestor of the modern cow. Both species were widely distributed throughout Eurasia and even North Africa. Map 5 shows the distribution of some of the wild ancestors of modern domesticated crops, such as Oryza sativa, the ancestor of Asian cultivated rice, and the ancestors of modern wheat and barley. It demonstrates that the wild ancestor of rice was distributed widely across South and Southeast Asia, while the ancestors of barley and wheat were distributed along a long arc from the Levant, reaching through Iran and into Afghanistan and the cluster of stans, Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan. These ancestral species are present in much of Eurasia, but their wide distribution suggests that inequality within Eurasia cannot be explained by a theory based on the incidence of the species. The geography hypothesis is not only unhelpful for explaining the origins of prosperity throughout history, and mostly incorrect in its emphasis, but also unable to account for the lay of the land we started this chapter with. One might argue that any persistent pattern, such as the hierarchy of incomes within the Americas, or the sharp and long-ranging differences between Europe and the Middle East, can be explained by unchanging geography. But this is not so. We have already seen that the patterns within the Americas are highly unlikely to have been driven by geographical factors. Before 1492, it was the civilizations in the Central Valley of Mexico, Central America, and the Andes that had superior technology and living standards to North America, or places such as Argentina and Chile. While the geography stayed the same, the institutions imposed by European colonists created a reversal of fortune. Geography is also unlikely to explain the poverty of the Middle East for similar reasons. After all, the Middle East led the world in the Neolithic Revolution, and the first towns developed in modern Iraq. Iron was first smelted in Turkey, and as late as the Middle Ages, the Middle East was technologically dynamic. It was not the geography of the Middle East that made the Neolithic Revolution flourish in that part of the world, as we will see in Chapter 5. And it was, again, not geography that made the Middle East poor. Instead, it was the expansion and consolidation of the Ottoman Empire. And it is the institutional legacy of this empire that keeps the Middle East poor today. Finally, geographic factors are unhelpful for explaining not only the differences we see across various parts of the world today, but also why many nations, such as Japan or China, stagnate for long periods and then start a rapid growth process. We need another, better theory. The culture hypothesis. The second widely accepted theory, the culture hypothesis, relates prosperity to culture. The culture hypothesis, just like the geography hypothesis, has a distinguished lineage, going back at least to the great German sociologist Max Weber, who argued that the Protestant Reformation and the Protestant ethic it spurred played a key role in facilitating the rise of modern industrial society in Western Europe. The culture hypothesis no longer relies solely on religion, but stresses other types of beliefs, values, and ethics as well. Though it is not politically correct to articulate in public, many people still maintain that Africans are poor because they lack a good work ethic, still believe in witchcraft and magic, or resist new Western technologies. Many also believe that Latin America will never be rich because its people are intrinsically profligate and impecunious, and because they suffer from some Iberian or Manana culture. Of course, many once believed that the Chinese culture and Confucian values were inimical to economic growth, though now the importance of the Chinese work ethic as the engine of growth in China, Hong Kong, and Singapore is trumpeted. Is the culture hypothesis useful for understanding world inequality? Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that social norms, which are related to culture, matter and can be hard to change, and they also sometimes support institutional differences, this book's explanation for world inequality. But mostly, no, because those aspects of culture often emphasized, religion, national ethics, African or Latin values, are just not important for understanding how we got here, and why the inequalities in the world persist. Other aspects, such as the extent to which people trust each other or are able to cooperate, are important, but they are mostly an outcome of institutions, not an independent cause. Let us go back to Nogales. As we noted earlier, many aspects of culture are the same north and south of the fence. Nevertheless, there may be some marked differences in practices, norms, and values, though these are not causes but outcomes of the two places' divergent development paths. For example, in surveys, Mexicans typically say they trust other people less than the citizens of the United States say they trust others. But it is not a surprise that Mexicans lack trust when their government cannot eliminate drug cartels or provide a functioning, unbiased legal system. The same is true with North and South Korea, as we discuss in the next chapter. The South is one of the richest countries in the world, while the North grapples with periodic famine and abject poverty. While culture is very different between the South and the North today, it played no role in causing the diverging economic fortunes of these two half-nations. The Korean Peninsula has a long period of common history. Before the Korean War and the division at the 38th parallel, it had an unprecedented homogeneity in terms of language, ethnicity, and culture. Just as in Nogales, what matters is the border. To the north is a different regime, imposing different institutions, creating different incentives. Any difference in culture between south and north of the border, cutting through the two parts of Nogales or the two parts of Korea, is thus not a cause of the differences in prosperity, but rather a consequence. What about Africa and African culture? Historically, sub-Saharan Africa was poorer than most other parts of the world, and its ancient civilizations did not develop the wheel, writing, with the exception of Ethiopia and Somalia, or the plow. Though these technologies were not widely used until the advent of formal European colonization in the late 19th and early 20th century, African societies knew about them much earlier. Europeans began sailing around the West Coast in the late 15th century, and Asians were continually sailing to East Africa from much earlier times. We can understand why these technologies were not adopted from the history of the Kingdom of Congo at the mouth of the Congo River, which has given its name to the modern Democratic Republic of Congo. Map 6 shows where the Congo was, along with another important Central African state, the Kuba Kingdom, which we discuss later in the book. Congo came into intense contact with the Portuguese after it was first visited by the mariner Diogo Cao in 1483. At the time, Congo was a highly centralized polity by African standards, whose capital, Mbanza, had a population of 60,000, which made it about the same size as the Portuguese capital of Lisbon and larger than London, which had a population of about 50,000 in 1500. The king of Congo, Nzinga a Nkuwu, converted to Catholicism and changed his name to João I. Later, Mbanza's name was changed to São Salvador. Thanks to the Portuguese, the Congolese learned about the wheel and the plow, and the Portuguese even encouraged their adoption with agricultural missions in 1491 and 1512. But all these initiatives failed. Still, the Congolese were far from averse to modern technologies in general. They were very quick to adopt one venerable Western innovation, the gun. They used this new and powerful tool to respond to market incentives, to capture and export slaves. There is no sign here that African values or culture prevented the adoption of new technologies and practices. As their contacts with Europeans deepened, the Congolese adopted other Western practices, literacy, dress styles, and house designs. In the 19th century, many African societies also took advantage of the rising economic opportunities created by the Industrial Revolution by changing their production patterns. In West Africa, there was rapid economic development based on the export of palm oil and ground nuts. Throughout southern Africa, Africans developed exports to the rapidly expanding industrial and mining areas of the Rand in South Africa. Yet these promising economic experiments were obliterated, not by African culture or the inability of ordinary Africans to act in their own self-interest, but first by European colonialism and then by post-independence African governments. The real reason that the Congolese did not adopt superior technology was because they lacked any incentives to do so. They faced a high risk of all their output being expropriated and taxed by the all-powerful king, whether or not he had converted to Catholicism. In fact, it wasn't only their property that was insecure. their continued existence was held by a thread. Many of them were captured and sold as slaves. Hardly the environment to encourage investment to increase long-term productivity. Neither did the king have incentives to adopt the plow on a large scale, or to make increasing agricultural productivity his main priority. Exporting slaves was so much more profitable. It might be true today that Africans trust each other less than people in other parts of the world, but this is an outcome of a long history of institutions which have undermined human and property rights in Africa. The potential to be captured and sold as a slave no doubt influenced the extent to which Africans trusted others historically. What about Max Weber's Protestant ethic? Though it may be true that predominantly Protestant countries such as the Netherlands and England were the first economic successes of the modern era, there is little relationship between religion and economic success. France, a predominantly Catholic country, quickly mimicked the economic performance of the Dutch and English in the 19th century, and Italy is as prosperous as any of these nations today. Looking farther east, you'll see that none of the economic successes of East Asia have anything to do with any form of Christian religion. So there is not much support for a special relationship between Protestantism and economic success there, either. Let's turn to a favorite area for the enthusiasts of the culture hypothesis, the Middle East. Middle Eastern countries are primarily Islamic, and the non-oil producers among them are very poor, as we have already noted. Oil producers are richer, but this windfall of wealth has done little to create diversified modern economies in Saudi Arabia or Kuwait. Don't these facts show convincingly that religion matters? Though plausible, this argument is not right either. Yes, countries such as Syria and Egypt are poor, and their populations are primarily Muslim. But these countries also systemically differ in other ways that are far more important for prosperity. For one, they were all provinces of the Ottoman Empire, which heavily and adversely shaped the way they developed. After Ottoman rule collapsed, the Middle East was absorbed into the English and French colonial empires, which again stunted their possibilities. After independence, they followed much of the former colonial world by developing hierarchical, authoritarian political regimes, with few of the political and economic institutions that, we will argue, are crucial for generating economic success. This development path was forged largely by the history of Ottoman and European rule. The relationship between the Islamic religion and poverty in the Middle East is largely spurious. The role of these historical events, rather than cultural factors, in shaping the Middle East's economic trajectory is also seen in the fact that the parts of the Middle East that temporarily broke away from the hold of the Ottoman Empire and the European powers, such as Egypt between 1805 and 1848 under Muhammad Ali, could embark on a path of rapid economic change. Muhammad Ali usurped power following the withdrawal of the French forces that had occupied Egypt under Napoleon Bonaparte. Exploiting the weakness of the Ottoman hold over the Egyptian territory at the time, he was able to found his own dynasty, which would, in one form or another, rule until the Egyptian Revolution under Nasser in 1952. Muhammad Ali's reforms, though coercive, did bring growth to Egypt as the state bureaucracy, the army, and the tax system were modernized, and there was growth in agriculture and industry. Nevertheless, this process of modernization and growth came to an end after Ali's death, as Egypt fell under European influence. But perhaps this is the wrong way to think about culture. Maybe the cultural factors that matter are not tied to religion, but rather to particular national cultures. Perhaps it is the influence of English culture that is important and explains why countries such as the United States, Canada, and Australia are so prosperous. Though this idea sounds initially appealing, it doesn't work either. Yes, Canada and the United States were English colonies, but so were Sierra Leone and Nigeria. The variation in prosperity within former English colonies is as great as that in the entire world. The English legacy is not the reason for the success of North America. There is yet one more version of the culture hypothesis. Perhaps it is not English versus non-English that matters, but rather European versus non-European. Could it be that Europeans are superior somehow because of their work ethic, outlook on life, Judeo-Christian values, or Roman heritage? It is true that Western Europe and North America, filled primarily by people of European descent, are the most prosperous parts of the world. Perhaps it is the superior European cultural legacy that is at the root of prosperity, and the last refuge of the culture hypothesis. Alas, this version of the culture hypothesis has as little explanatory potential as the others. A greater proportion of the population of Argentina and Uruguay, compared with the population of Canada and the United States, is of European descent. But Argentina and Uruguay's economic performance leaves much to be desired. Japan and Singapore never had more than a sprinkling of inhabitants of European descent, yet they are as prosperous as many parts of Western Europe. China, despite many imperfections in its economic and political system, has been the most rapidly growing nation of the past three decades. Chinese poverty, until Mao Zedong's death, had nothing to do with Chinese culture. It was due to the disastrous way Mao organized the economy and conducted politics. In the 1950s, he promoted the Great Leap Forward, a drastic industrialization policy that led to mass starvation and famine. In the 1960s, he propagated the Cultural Revolution, which led to the mass persecution of intellectuals and educated people, anyone whose party loyalty might be doubted. This again led to terror and to a huge waste of the society's talent and resources. In the same way, current Chinese growth has nothing to do with Chinese values or changes in Chinese culture. It results from a process of economic transformation, unleashed by the reforms implemented by Deng Xiaoping and his allies, who, after Mao Zedong's death, gradually abandoned socialist economic policies and institutions, first in agriculture and then in industry. Just like the geography hypothesis, the culture hypothesis is also unhelpful for explaining other aspects of the lay of the land around us today. There are, of course, differences in beliefs, cultural attitudes, and values between the United States and Latin America. But just like those that exist between Nogales, Arizona and Nogales, Sonora, or those between South and North Korea, these differences are a consequence of the two places' different institutions and institutional histories. Cultural factors that emphasize how Hispanic or Latin culture molded the Spanish Empire can't explain the differences within Latin America. For example, why Argentina and Chile are more prosperous than Peru and Bolivia. Other types of cultural arguments, for instance, those that stress contemporary indigenous culture, fare equally badly. Argentina and Chile have few indigenous people compared with Peru and Bolivia. Though this is true, indigenous culture as an explanation does not work either. Colombia, Ecuador, and Peru have similar income levels, but Colombia has very few indigenous people today, while Ecuador and Peru have many. Finally, cultural attitudes, which are in general slow to change, are unlikely to account by themselves for the growth miracles in East Asia and China. Though institutions are persistent too, in certain circumstances, they do change rapidly, as we'll see. The Ignorance Hypothesis. The final popular theory for why some nations are poor and some are rich is the Ignorance Hypothesis, which asserts that world inequality exists because we or our rulers do not know how to make poor countries rich. This idea is the one held by most economists, who take their cue from the famous definition proposed by the English economist Lionel Robbins in 1935, that economics is a science which studies human behavior as a relationship between ends and scarce means, which have alternative uses. It is then a small step to conclude that the science of economics should focus on the best use of scarce means to satisfy social ends. Indeed, the most famous theoretical result in economics, the so-called first welfare theorem, identifies the circumstances under which the allocation of resources in a market economy is socially desirable from an economic point of view. A market economy is an abstraction that is meant to capture a situation in which all individuals and firms can freely produce, buy, and sell any products or services that they wish. When these circumstances are not present, there is a market failure. Such failures provide the basis for a theory of world inequality, since the more that market failures go unaddressed, the poorer a country is likely to be. The Ignorance Hypothesis maintains that poor countries are poor because they have a lot of market failures and because economists and policymakers do not know how to get rid of them and have heeded the wrong advice in the past. Rich countries are rich because they have figured out better policies and have successfully eliminated these failures. Could the ignorance hypothesis explain world inequality? Could it be that African countries are poorer than the rest of the world because their leaders tend to have the same mistaken views of how to run their countries, leading to the poverty there, while Western European leaders are better informed or better advised, which explains their relative success? While there are famous examples of leaders adopting disastrous policies because they were mistaken about those policies' consequences, ignorance can explain at best a small part of world inequality. On the face of it, the sustained economic decline that soon set in Ghana after independence from Britain was caused by ignorance. The British economist Tony Killick, then working as an advisor for the government of Kwame Nkrumah, recorded many of the problems in great detail. Nkrumah's policies focused on developing state industry, which turned out to be very inefficient. Killick recalled the footwear factory that would have linked the meat factory in the north through transportation of the hides to the south for a distance of over 500 miles to a tannery now abandoned. The leather was to have been backhauled to the footwear factory in Kumasi, in the center of the country and about 200 miles north of the tannery. Since the major footwear market is in the Accra metropolitan area, the shoes would then have to be transported an additional 200 miles back to the south. Killick, somewhat understatedly, remarks that this was an enterprise whose viability was undermined by poor siting. The footwear factory was one of many such projects, joined by the mango canning plant situated in a part of Ghana which did not grow mangoes and whose output was to be more than the entire world demand for the product. This endless stream of economically irrational developments was not caused by the fact that Nkrumah or his advisors were badly informed or ignorant of the right economic policies. They had people like Killick and had even been advised by Nobel laureate Sir Arthur Lewis, who knew the policies were not good. What drove the form the economic policies took was the fact that Nkrumah needed to use them to buy political support and sustain his undemocratic regime. Neither Ghana's disappointing performance after independence, nor the countless other cases of apparent economic mismanagement, can simply be blamed on ignorance. After all, if ignorance were the problem, well-meaning leaders would quickly learn what types of policies increase their citizens' incomes and welfare, and would gravitate toward those policies. Consider the divergent paths of the United States and Mexico. Blaming this disparity on the ignorance of the leaders of the two nations is, at best, highly implausible. It wasn't differences in knowledge or intentions between John Smith and Cortes that laid the seeds of divergence during the colonial period. And it wasn't differences in knowledge between later U.S. presidents, such as Teddy Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson and Porfirio Diaz, that made Mexico choose economic institutions that enriched elites at the expense of the rest of society at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th centuries, while Roosevelt and Wilson did the opposite. Rather, it was the differences in the institutional constraints the country's presidents and elites were facing. Similarly, leaders of African nations that have languished over the last half century under insecure property rights and economic institutions, impoverishing much of their populations, did not allow this to happen because they thought it was good economics. They did so because they could get away with it and enrich themselves at the expense of the rest, or because they thought it was good politics, a way of keeping themselves in power by buying the support of crucial groups or elites. The experience of Ghana's prime minister in 1971, Kofi Busia, illustrates how misleading the ignorance hypothesis can be. Busia faced a dangerous economic crisis. After coming to power in 1969, he, like Nkrumah before him, pursued unsustainable expansionary economic policies and maintained various price controls through marketing boards and an overvalued exchange rate. Though Busia had been an opponent of Nkrumah and led a democratic government, he faced many of the same political constraints. As with Nkrumah, his economic policies were adopted not because he was ignorant and believed that these policies were good economics or an ideal way to develop the country. The policies were chosen because they were good politics, enabling Busia to transfer resources to politically powerful groups, for example in urban areas, who needed to be kept contented. Price controls squeezed agriculture, delivering cheap food to the urban constituencies and generating revenues to finance government spending. But these controls were unsustainable. Ghana was soon suffering from a series of balance of payment crises and foreign exchange shortages. Faced with these dilemmas, on December 27, 1971, Bousia signed an agreement with the International Monetary Fund that included a massive devaluation of the currency. The IMF, the World Bank, and the entire international community put pressure on Bousia to implement the reforms contained in the agreement. Though the international institutions were blissfully unaware, Bousia knew he was taking a huge political gamble. The immediate consequence of the currency's devaluation was rioting and discontent in Accra, Ghana's capital, that mounted uncontrollably until Bousia was overthrown by the military, led by Lieutenant Colonel Achiampong, who immediately reversed the devaluation. The ignorance hypothesis differs from the geography and culture hypotheses in that it comes readily with a suggestion about how to solve the problem of poverty. If ignorance got us here, enlightened and informed rulers and policymakers can get us out, and we should be able to engineer prosperity around the world by providing the right advice and by convincing politicians of what is good economics. Yet Bousia's experience underscores the fact that the main obstacle to the adoption of policies that would reduce market failures and encourage economic growth is not the ignorance of politicians, but the incentives and constraints they face from the political and economic institutions in their societies. Although the ignorance hypothesis still rules supreme among most economists and in Western policymaking circles, which, almost to the exclusion of anything else, focus on how to engineer prosperity, it is just another hypothesis that doesn't work. It explains neither the origins of prosperity around the world, nor the lay of the land around us. For example, why some nations, such as Mexico and Peru, but not the United States or England, adopted institutions and policies that would impoverish the majority of their citizens, or why almost all sub-Saharan Africa and most of Central America are so much poorer than Western Europe or East Asia. When nations break out of institutional patterns condemning them to poverty and manage to embark on a path to economic growth, this is not because their ignorant leaders suddenly have become better informed, or less self-interested, or because they've received advice from better economists. China, for example, is one of the countries that made the switch from economic policies that caused poverty and the starvation of millions to those encouraging economic growth. But, as we will discuss in greater detail later, this did not happen because the Chinese Communist Party finally understood that the collective ownership of agricultural land and industry created terrible economic incentives. Instead, Deng Xiaoping and his allies, who were no less self-interested than their rivals, but who had different interests and political objectives, defeated their powerful opponents in the Communist Party and masterminded a political revolution of sorts, radically changing the leadership and direction of the party. Their economic reforms, which created market incentives in agriculture and then subsequently in industry, followed from this political revolution. It was politics that determined the switch from communism and toward market incentives in China, not better advice or a better understanding of how the economy worked. We will argue that to understand world inequality, we have to understand why some societies are organized in very inefficient and socially undesirable ways. Nations sometimes do manage to adopt efficient institutions and achieve prosperity, but alas, these are the rare cases. Most economists and policymakers have focused on getting it right, while what is really needed is an explanation for why poor nations get it wrong. Getting it wrong is mostly not about ignorance or culture. As we will show, poor countries are poor because those who have power make choices that create poverty. They get it wrong not by mistake or ignorance, but on purpose. To understand this, you have to go beyond economics and expert advice on the best thing to do, and instead study how decisions actually get made, who gets to make them, and why those people decide to do what they do. This is the study of politics and political processes. Traditionally, economics has ignored politics, but understanding politics is crucial for explaining world inequality. As the economist Abba Lerner noted in the 1970s, Economics has gained the title Queen of the Social Sciences by choosing solved political problems as its domain. We will argue that achieving prosperity depends on solving some basic political problems. It is precisely because economics has assumed that political problems are solved that it has not been able to come up with a convincing explanation for world inequality. Explaining world inequality still needs economics to understand how different types of policies and social arrangements affect economic incentives and behavior. But it also needs politics. Chapter 3. The Making of Prosperity and Poverty. The Economics of the 38th Parallel. In the summer of 1945, as the Second World War was drawing to a close, the Japanese colony in Korea began to collapse. Within a month of Japan's August 15th unconditional surrender, Korea was divided at the 38th parallel into two spheres of influence. The South was administered by the United States, the North by Russia. The uneasy peace of the Cold War was shattered in June 1950 when the North Korean army invaded the South. Though initially the North Koreans made large inroads, capturing the capital city, Seoul, by the autumn, they were in full retreat. It was then that Hwang Pyeonwon and his brother were separated. Hwang Pyeonwon managed to hide and avoid being drafted into the North Korean army. He stayed in the South and worked as a pharmacist. His brother, a doctor working in Seoul treating wounded soldiers from the South Korean army, was taken north as the North Korean army retreated. Dragged apart in 1950, they met again in 2000 in Seoul for the first time in 50 years, after the two governments finally agreed to initiate a limited program of family reunification. As a doctor, Hwang Pyeonwon's brother had ended up working for the Air Force, a good job in a military dictatorship. But even those with privileges in North Korea don't do that well. When the brothers met, Hwang Pyeonwon asked about how life was north of the 38th parallel. He had a car, but his brother didn't. "Do you have a telephone?" he asked his brother. "No," said his brother. "My daughter, who works at the foreign ministry, has a phone, but if you don't know the code, you can't call." Hwang Pyeonwon recalled how all the people from the north at the reunion were asking for money, so he offered some to his brother. But his brother said, "If I go back with money, the government will say, 'Give that money to us,' so keep it." Hwang Pyeonwon noticed his brother's coat was threadbare. "Take off that coat and leave it, and when you go back, wear this one," he suggested. "I can't do that," his brother replied. "This is just borrowed from the government to come here." Hwang Pyeonwon recalled how, when they parted, his brother was ill at ease and always nervous as though someone were listening. He was poorer than Hwang Pyeonwon imagined. His brother said he lived well, but Hwang Pyeonwon thought he looked awful and was thin as a rake. The people of South Korea have living standards similar to those of Portugal and Spain. To the north, in the so-called Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or North Korea, living standards are akin to those of a sub-Saharan African country, about one-tenth of average living standards in South Korea. The health of North Koreans is in an even worse state. The average North Korean can expect to live 10 years less than his cousins south of the 38th parallel. Map 7 illustrates in a dramatic way the economic gap between the Koreas. It plots data on the intensity of light at night from satellite images. North Korea is almost completely dark due to lack of electricity. South Korea is blazing with light. These striking differences are not ancient. In fact, they did not exist prior to the end of the Second World War. But after 1945, the different governments in the North and the South adopted very different ways of organizing their economies. South Korea was led, and its early economic and political institutions were shaped, by the Harvard and Princeton-educated, staunchly anti-communists Sungmon Rhee, with significant support from the United States. Rhee was elected president in 1948, forged in the midst of the Korean War and against the threat of communism spreading to the south of the 38th parallel. South Korea was no democracy. Both Rhee and his equally famous successor, General Park Chung-hee, secured their places in history as authoritarian presidents. But both governed a market economy where private property was recognized, and after 1961, Park effectively threw the weight of the state behind rapid economic growth, channeling credit and subsidies to firms that were successful. The situation north of the 38th parallel was different. Kim Il-sung, a leader of anti-Japanese communist partisans during the Second World War, established himself as dictator by 1947, and with the help of the Soviet Union, introduced a rigid form of a centrally planned economy as part of the so-called Juche system. Private property was outlawed, and markets were banned. Freedoms were curtailed not only in the marketplace, but in every sphere of North Koreans' lives, except for those who happened to be part of the very small ruling elite around Kim Il-sung, and later his son and successor, Kim Jong-il. It should not surprise us that the economic fortunes of South and North Korea diverged sharply. Kim Il-sung's command economy and the Juche system soon proved to be a disaster. Detailed statistics are not available from North Korea, which is a secretive state, to say the least. Nonetheless, available evidence confirms what we know from the all-too-often recurring famines. Not only did industrial production fail to take off, but North Korea, in fact, experienced a collapse in agricultural productivity. Lack of private property meant that few people had incentives to invest or to exert effort to increase or even maintain productivity. The stifling, repressive regime was inimical to innovation and the adoption of new technologies. But Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and their cronies had no intention of reforming the system or introducing private property, markets, private contracts, or changing economic and political institutions. North Korea continues to stagnate economically. Meanwhile, in the South, economic institutions encouraged investment and trade. South Korean politicians invested in education, achieving high rates of literacy and schooling. South Korean companies were quick to take advantage of the relatively educated population, the policies encouraging investment and industrialization, exports, and the transfer of technology. South Korea quickly became one of East Asia's miracle economies, one of the most rapidly growing nations in the world. By the late 1990s, in just about half a century, South Korean growth and North Korean stagnation led to a tenfold gap between the two halves of this once united country. Imagine what a difference a couple of centuries could make. The economic disaster of North Korea, which led to the starvation of millions, when placed against the South Korean economic success, is striking. Neither culture, nor geography, nor ignorance can explain the divergent paths of North and South Korea. We have to look at institutions for an answer. Extractive and inclusive economic institutions. Countries differ in their economic success because of their different institutions, the rules influencing how the economy works, and the incentives that motivate people. Imagine teenagers in North and South Korea and what they expect from life. Those in the North grow up in poverty, without entrepreneurial initiative, creativity, or adequate education to prepare them for skilled work. Much of the education they receive at school is pure propaganda, meant to shore up the legitimacy of the regime. There are few books, let alone computers. After finishing school, everyone has to go into the army for 10 years. These teenagers know that they will not be able to own property, start a business, or become more prosperous, even if many people engage illegally in private economic activities to make a living. They also know that they will not have legal access to markets where they can use their skills or their earnings to purchase the goods they need and desire. They are even unsure about what kind of human rights they will have. Those in the South obtain a good education and face incentives that encourage them to exert effort and excel in their chosen vocation. South Korea is a market economy, built on private property. South Korean teenagers know that, if successful as entrepreneurs or workers, they can one day enjoy the fruits of their investments and efforts. They can improve their standard of living and buy cars, houses, and health care. In the South, the state supports economic activity and upholds law and order. So it is possible for entrepreneurs to borrow money from banks and financial markets, for foreign companies to enter into partnerships with South Korean firms, for individuals to take up mortgages to buy houses. In the South, by and large, you are free to open any business you like. In the North, you are not. In the South, you can hire workers, sell your products or services, and spend your money in the marketplace in whichever way you want. In the North, there are only black markets. These different rules are the institutions under which North and South Koreans live. Inclusive economic institutions, such as those in South Korea or in the United States, are those that allow and encourage participation by the great mass of people in economic activities that make best use of their talents and skills, and that enable individuals to make the choices they wish. To be inclusive, economic institutions must feature secure private property, an unbiased system of law, and the provision of public services that provides a level playing field in which people can exchange and contract. It also must permit the entry of new businesses and allow people to choose their careers. The contrast of South and North Korea and of the United States and Latin America illustrates a general principle. Inclusive economic institutions foster economic activity, productivity growth, and economic prosperity. Secure private property rights are central, since only those with such rights will be willing to invest and increase productivity. A businessman who expects his output to be stolen, expropriated, or entirely taxed away will have little incentive to work, let alone any incentive to undertake investments and innovations. But such rights must exist for the majority of people in society. In 1680, the English government conducted a census of the population of its West Indian colony of Barbados. The census revealed that of the total population on the island of around 60,000, almost 39,000 were African slaves, who were the property of the remaining one-third of the population. Indeed, they were mostly the property of the largest 175 sugar planters, who also owned most of the land. These large planters had secure and well-enforced property rights over their land and even over their slaves. If one planter wanted to sell slaves to another, he could do so and expect a court to enforce such a sale or any other contract he wrote. Why? Of the 40 judges and justices of the peace on the island, 29 of them were large planters. Also, the 8 most senior military officials were all large planters. Despite well-defined, secure, and enforced property rights and contracts for the island's elite, Barbados did not have inclusive economic institutions, since two-thirds of the population were slaves with no access to education or economic opportunities, and no ability or incentive to use their talents or skills. Inclusive economic institutions require secure property rights and economic opportunities, not just for the elite, but for a broad cross-section of society. Secure property rights, the law, public services, and the freedom to contract and exchange all rely on the state, the institution with the coercive capacity to impose order, prevent theft and fraud, and enforce contracts between private parties. To function well, society also needs other public services, roads and a transport network so that goods can be transported, a public infrastructure so that economic activity can flourish, and some type of basic regulation to prevent fraud and malfeasance. Though many of these public services can be provided by markets and private citizens, the degree of coordination necessary to do so on a large scale often eludes all but a central authority. The state is thus inexorably intertwined with economic institutions as the enforcer of law and order, private property, and contracts, and often as a key provider of public services. Inclusive economic institutions need and use the state. The economic institutions of North Korea or of colonial Latin America, the mita, encomienda, or repartimiento described earlier, do not have these properties. Private property is non-existent in North Korea. In colonial Latin America, there was private property for Spaniards, but the property of the indigenous peoples was highly insecure. In neither type of society was the vast mass of people able to make the economic decisions they wanted to. They were subject to mass coercion. In neither type of society was the power of the state used to provide key public services that promoted prosperity. In North Korea, the state built an education system to inculcate propaganda, but was unable to prevent famine. In colonial Latin America, the state focused on coercing indigenous peoples. In neither type of society was there a level playing field or an unbiased legal system. In North Korea, the legal system is an arm of the ruling Communist Party, and in Latin America, it was a tool of discrimination against the mass of people. We call such institutions, which have opposite properties to those we call inclusive, extractive economic institutions. Extractive because such institutions are designed to extract incomes and wealth from one subset of society to benefit a different subset. Engines of prosperity. Inclusive economic institutions create inclusive markets, which not only give people freedom to pursue the vocations in life that best suit their talents, but also provide a level playing field that gives them the opportunity to do so. Those who have good ideas will be able to start businesses. Workers will tend to go to activities where their productivity is greater, and less efficient firms can be replaced by more efficient ones. Contrast how people choose their occupations under inclusive markets to colonial Peru and Bolivia, where under the Mita, many were forced to work in silver and mercury mines, regardless of their skills or whether they wanted to. Inclusive markets are not just free markets. Barbados in the 17th century also had markets, but in the same way that it lacked property rights for all but the narrow planter elite, its markets were far from inclusive. Markets and slaves were in fact one part of the economic institutions systematically coercing the majority of the population and robbing them of the ability to choose their occupations and how they should utilize their talents. Inclusive economic institutions also paved the way for two other engines of prosperity, technology and education. Sustained economic growth is almost always accompanied by technological improvements that enable people, labor, land and existing capital, buildings, existing machines, and so on, to become more productive. Think of our great-great-grandparents, just over a century ago, who did not have access to planes or automobiles or most of the drugs and health care we now take for granted, not to mention indoor plumbing, air conditioning, shopping malls, radio or motion pictures, let alone information technology, robotics, or computer-controlled machinery. And going back a few more generations, the technological know-how and living standards were even more backward, so much so that we would find it hard to imagine how most people struggled through life. These improvements follow from science and from entrepreneurs such as Thomas Edison, who applied science to create profitable businesses. This process of innovation is made possible by economic institutions that encourage private property, uphold contracts, create a level playing field, and encourage and allow the entry of new businesses that can bring new technologies to life. It should therefore be no surprise that it was U.S. society, not Mexico or Peru, that produced Thomas Edison, and that it was South Korea, not North Korea, that today produces technologically innovative companies, such as Samsung and Hyundai. Intimately linked to technology are the education, skills, competencies, and know-how of the workforce acquired in schools, at home, and on the job. We are so much more productive than a century ago, not just because of better technology embodied in machines, but also because of the greater know-how that workers possess. All the technology in the world would be of little use without workers who knew how to operate it. But there is more to skills and competencies than just the ability to run machines. It is the education and skills of the workforce that generate the scientific knowledge upon which our progress is built, and then enable the adaptation and adoption of these technologies in diverse lines of business. Though we saw in Chapter 1 that many of the innovators of the Industrial Revolution and afterward, like Thomas Edison, were not highly educated, these innovations were much simpler than modern technology. Today, technological change requires education, both for the innovator and the worker. And here we see the importance of economic institutions that create a level playing field. The United States could produce, or attract from foreign lands, the likes of Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, and Jeff Bezos, and the hundreds of scientists who made fundamental discoveries in information technology, nuclear power, biotech, and other fields upon which these entrepreneurs built their businesses. The supply of talent was there to be harnessed because most teenagers in the United States have access to as much schooling as they wish or are capable of attaining. Now, imagine a different society, for example, the Congo or Haiti, where a large fraction of the population has no means of attending school, or where, if they manage to go to school, the quality of teaching is lamentable, where teachers do not show up for work, and even if they do, there may not be any books. The low education level of poor countries is caused by economic institutions that fail to create incentives for parents to educate their children, and by political institutions that fail to induce the government to build, finance, and support schools and the wishes of parents and children. The price these nations pay for low education of their population and lack of inclusive markets is high. They fail to mobilize their nascent talent. They have many potential Bill Gateses and perhaps one or two Albert Einsteins who are now working as poor, uneducated farmers, being coerced to do what they don't want to do, or being drafted into the army, because they never had the opportunity to realize their vocation in life. The ability of economic institutions to harness the potential of inclusive markets, encourage technological innovation, invest in people, and mobilize the talents and skills of a large number of individuals is critical for economic growth. Explaining why so many economic institutions fail to meet these simple objectives is the central theme of this book. Extractive and inclusive political institutions. All economic institutions are created by society. Those of North Korea, for example, were forced on its citizens by the communists who took over the country in the 1940s, while those of colonial Latin America were imposed by Spanish conquistadors. South Korea ended up with very different economic institutions than the North because different people with different interests and objectives made the decisions about how to structure society. In other words, South Korea had different politics. Politics is the process by which a society chooses the rules that will govern it. Politics surrounds institutions, for the simple reason that while inclusive institutions may be good for the economic prosperity of a nation, some people or groups, such as the elite of the Communist Party of North Korea or the sugar planters of colonial Barbados, will be much better off by setting up institutions that are extractive. When there is conflict over institutions, what happens depends on which people or group wins out in the game of politics, who can get more support, obtain additional resources, and form more effective alliances. In short, who wins depends on the distribution of political power in society. The political institutions of a society are a key determinant of the outcome of this game. They are the rules that govern incentives in politics. They determine how the government is chosen and which part of the government has the right to do what. Political institutions determine who has power in society and to what ends that power can be used. If the distribution of power is narrow and unconstrained, then the political institutions are absolutist, as exemplified by the absolutist monarchies reigning throughout the world during much of history. Under absolutist political institutions such as those in North Korea and colonial Latin America, those who can wield this power will be able to set up economic institutions to enrich themselves and augment their power at the expense of society. In contrast, political institutions that distribute power broadly in society and subject it to constraints are pluralistic. Instead of being vested in a single individual or a narrow group, political power rests with a broad coalition or a plurality of groups. There is obviously a close connection between pluralism and inclusive economic institutions. But the key to understanding why South Korea and the United States have inclusive economic institutions is not just their pluralistic political institutions, but also their sufficiently centralized and powerful states. A telling contrast is with the East African nation of Somalia. As we will see later in the book, political power in Somalia has long been widely distributed, almost pluralistic. Indeed, there is no real authority that can control or sanction what anyone does. Society is divided into deeply antagonistic clans that cannot dominate one another. The power of one clan is constrained only by the guns of another. The distribution of power leads not to inclusive institutions, but to chaos. And at the root of it is the Somali state's lack of any kind of political centralization or state centralization, and its inability to enforce even the minimal amount of law and order to support economic activity, trade, or even the basic security of its citizens. Max Weber, who we met in the previous chapter, provided the most famous and widely accepted definition of the state, identifying it with the monopoly of legitimate violence in society. Without such a monopoly and the degree of centralization that it entails, the state cannot play its role as enforcer of law and order, let alone provide public services and encourage and regulate economic activity. When the state fails to achieve almost any political centralization, society, sooner or later, descends into chaos, as did Somalia. We will refer to political institutions that are sufficiently centralized and pluralistic as inclusive political institutions. When either of these conditions fails, we will refer to the institutions as extractive political institutions. There is strong synergy between economic and political institutions. Extractive political institutions concentrate power in the hands of a narrow elite and place few constraints on the exercise of this power. Economic institutions are then often structured by this elite to extract resources from the rest of the society. Extractive economic institutions thus naturally accompany extractive political institutions. In fact, they must inherently depend on extractive political institutions for their survival. Inclusive political institutions, vesting power broadly, would tend to uproot economic institutions that expropriate the resources of the many, erect entry barriers, and suppress the functioning of markets so that only a few benefit. In Barbados, for example, the plantation system, based on the exploitation of slaves, could not have survived without political institutions that suppressed and completely excluded the slaves from the political process. The economic system impoverishing millions for the benefit of a narrow communist elite in North Korea would also be unthinkable without the total political domination of the Communist Party. This synergistic relationship between extractive economic and political institutions introduces a strong feedback loop. Political institutions enable the elites controlling political power to choose economic institutions with few constraints or opposing forces. They also enable the elites to structure future political institutions and their evolution. Extractive economic institutions, in turn, enrich the same elites, and their economic wealth and power help consolidate their political dominance. In Barbados or in Latin America, for example, the colonists were able to use their political power to impose a set of economic institutions that made them huge fortunes at the expense of the rest of the population. The resources these economic institutions generated enabled these elites to build armies and security forces to defend their absolutist monopoly of political power. The implication, of course, is that extractive political and economic institutions support each other and tend to persist. There is, in fact, more to the synergy between extractive economic and political institutions. When existing elites are challenged under extractive political institutions and the newcomers break through, the newcomers are likewise subject to only a few constraints. They thus have incentives to maintain these political institutions and create a similar set of economic institutions, as Porfirio Diaz and the elite surrounding him did at the end of the 19th century in Mexico. Inclusive economic institutions, in turn, are forged on foundations laid by inclusive political institutions, which make power broadly distributed in society and constrain its arbitrary exercise. Such political institutions also make it harder for others to usurp power and undermine the foundations of inclusive institutions. Those controlling political power cannot easily use it to set up extractive economic institutions for their own benefit. Inclusive economic institutions, in turn, create a more equitable distribution of resources, facilitating the persistence of inclusive political institutions. It was not a coincidence that when, in 1618, the Virginia Company gave land and freedom from their draconian contracts to the colonists it had previously tried to coerce, the General Assembly in the following year allowed the colonists to begin governing themselves. Economic rights without political rights would not have been trusted by the colonists, who had seen the persistent efforts of the Virginia Company to coerce them. Neither would these economies have been stable and durable. In fact, combinations of extractive and inclusive institutions are generally unstable. Extractive economic institutions under inclusive political institutions are unlikely to survive for long, as our discussion of Barbados suggests. Similarly, inclusive economic institutions will neither support nor be supported by extractive political ones. Either they will be transformed into extractive economic institutions to the benefit of the narrow interests that hold power, or the economic dynamism they create will destabilize the extractive political institutions, opening the way for the emergence of inclusive political institutions.